Hello and welcome to the opening bell. My name's Matt Christie, and this week I'm joined by John Denon.
Hello.
It's been a while since we've been in here together doing this. Tris Dixon is out in Las Vegas for the Amir Khan Devon Alexander bill, leaving us here to do the podcast. We'll talk about the Las Vegas, all the fun and games that are going to take place in Las Vegas this weekend shortly. First of all, we'll focus on events that have already happened. David Lemieux against Gabriel Rosado at middleweight was perhaps the most notable fight of the weekend just passed. John, you said you saw clips of Lemieux. Were you impressed?
Yeah, and certainly from the Ringside Report we've got in this week's magazine, it looked like Lemieux dominated, which, you know, I was expecting it to be a harder fight against Rosado for him. And from what I saw, it definitely looked like, you know, we know he's a power puncher, he's come unstuck a couple of times. It looked like he was applying educated pressure against Rosado, and suddenly we've got another exciting top level middleweight.
All of a sudden the middleweight division is looking really, really exciting going into 2015, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so, especially if Canelo, as expected, steps up to middleweight.
So, yeah, you mentioned Lemieux's setbacks. I think one of the most impressive things for me against Rosado is that, I mean, there was a lot of whispers that he might come unstuck again against Rosado, given his opponent's, you know, toughness and everything else. He's, you know, one of the most durable fighters in the game, one of the most exciting fighters in the game, and what you will get from Rosado at the very least is a test. And he certainly gave that to Lemieux. But one of the most impressive things for me is the fact that he seems to have got his career back on track very often, because when he arrived on the scene, he was almost one of those can't-miss prospects. He looked like he was going to walk through everyone. And when fighters like that get their cloak of invincibility torn away, it's often very, very hard for them to realign their focus. But he's done that. Do you think he could be a threat? There were some whispers that he'll be, you know, a good opponent for Golovkin once Golovkin... If Golovkin gets past Martin Murray. Would you put him up there? Would you give him a chance against Gennady Golovkin?
With someone with a hard punch like that, you've got to give him a chance. I don't think anyone would pick Lemieux to beat Golovkin, but I think I still think it's a good fight. I think a lot of people would want to see it because you're guaranteed excitement. You know, his power could trouble Golovkin at some stage in the fight. But surely Golovkin would exploit Lemieux's vulnerabilities. So I think you're guaranteeing an exciting fight. I mean, it would be great if in 2015, if Golovkin were to get past Martin Murray, which he's expected to, if he then fights Lemieux in an exciting punch up while Cotto's fighting Canelo. And then towards the end of 2015, the winner of Cotto, Saul Alvarez, fights Golovkin. That would be pretty, pretty, pretty good.
we both kind of almost said when Golovkin beats Murray. Are we overlooking Murray? I was at the press conference near Piccadilly Circus last week and saw Gennady Golovkin, who is the most unassuming looking character.
Right.
If you were to kind of, you know, if you were to pick somebody out in that room last week that you wanted a fight with, and you knew, or you had to have a fight with someone,
and you knew nothing about boxing.
Golovkin there with his smile and his. Yeah, he just looks so. He almost looked delicate. He was overly polite. he was quite astonishing to kind of be that close to his company. But do you give Murray a chance? Golovkin has said that it's going to be his toughest fight, but that's kind of a well-versed pre-fight. Kind of thing that Golovkin says is very often full of respect.
Yeah, I do think Martin Murray is a very respectable opponent. You know, he did well against Sergio Martinez in Argentina, did well against Felix Sturm in Germany. He is up there at world level.
So did Macklin. Macklin did well against those guys as well, didn't he? And look what happened to him.
True. I tend to think Murray is sort of sounder defensively.
Yeah.
And he is, you know, he's a big lump. He is quite solid. I think that's what makes me think he can actually, you know, he can go some, you know, he's a tough guy as well. I think he can go some rounds with Golovkin. I suppose because Macklin, he has had a hard career, because Macklin tended to get in real fights with people he's better than. He got dragged down to their level. Whereas Murray, I don't think Murray has quite the same wear and tear on him. But yeah, I am factoring in the Golovkin victory. I think he's a very clear favourite in that one.
No, I'd have to agree with you.
But I think, you know, Murray could go the distance.
He might do. I think it'll do rounds. I think it will go rounds, that fight. What I'm really excited about, though, is the fact that it's on terrestrial television, that fight in February. So, you know, potentially it could get millions and millions of people could see, and Britain could see, you know, yeah, one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in boxing, which I can't remember the last time that happened.
Yeah.
Mick Hennessy was talking that he's hopeful that it will beat the records of, which currently stand in recent years, of Karl Frotch, Jean Pascal, which I believe did just under 3 million, and the leading fight at the moment in terms of viewing figures is the Tyson Fury Derek Chisora first fight, which did 3.2 million. Do you think that's realistic numbers for Golovkin Murray?
I don't know. Tyson Fury had a knack of people sort of knew who he was in the UK. So I don't know if I don't think Golovkin has sort of crossed over to like the mainstream British fan, but I really hope it does do really well. It certainly deserves to. But Tyson Fury, for whatever reason, has, you know, brought in the numbers.
Okay, let's move on to the Jean Pascal fight, if that's what we can call it. You saw that, didn't you?
I did. Well, yes.
What did you make of that, Jean Pascal Roberto Belonti? What, you know, for those that haven't heard, is that my take on it was that it was a fairly quiet opening round. Pascal certainly looked superior and fitter. Second round, he upped the pressure, dropped Belonti legitimately, and was really winging in some powerful blasts to the body, which seemed to be giving Belonti some trouble. And then the referee at some point seemed to call break when the two were in a clinch, and seconds, maybe even less than seconds, Pascal landed a right hand that Belonti dropped from as if he'd been shot.
Yeah.
And then it was eventually, after all the confusion, after Belonti had been taken off on a stretcher, it was called a no contest. There was, for a while, it was Pascal's camp were concerned that their man might be disqualified. What was your take on it?
You know, I am reluctant to sort of criticise, you know, a boxer who did leave the ring in a stretcher. So if Belonti was faking it to get Pascal disqualified, he really committed to the act, because he stayed down, he didn't move, they had to stretcher him out. But the punch that Pascal hit him with didn't look like much, didn't look like it was enough to put him out for the count like that. And Pascal's corner was certainly concerned that Belonti was just trying to get him disqualified. So, you know, and Belonti did leave hospital in the sort of, you know, early hours of the following morning. So the whole thing seemed a bit iffy. It didn't look good. To paraphrase Pascal's corner, it looked like a flipping European soccer dive.
Flipping?
That might not have been the word they used. are we allowed to swear on the podcast?
No, not unless we're getting really carried away.
All right, well,
you seem quite composed at the moment.
Flip you, Christy. yes, it didn't look good. I don't think people are going to be booking Belonti for any high-profile fights again anytime soon.
Belanti, kind of a gatekeeper type, I think, fringe contender, would probably be being a bit too kind. However, he's been a fairly durable guy, never before been stopped.
Yeah.
Which is what made it all, left a bit of a bad taste in the mouth, really, if we're honest.
The whole thing was weird. It was flipping weird.
It was flipping weird. But it reminded me, as I've said more than once recently, is it reminded me of the Terry Norris Luis Santana fight from, I think, 1993, when Santana went out in a very, very similar way from an apparently innocuous but illegal blow, and he went out and he got Norris's title, and he went out in a similar fashion on a stretcher and was very quickly deemed to be okay afterwards.
And Pascal, you know, it did look like Pascal was getting to him. Pascal was hurting him. Pascal looked good for the
this
very short time it
lasted. This is what I thought was a bit of a shame, really, from Pascal's point of view, is that I thought Pascal was looking really, really good. I remember when Pascal first burst onto the scene as a super middleweight, a little under 10 years ago, and I thought Pascal was something special then.
Yeah.
And he was kind of getting back to that. He had those two fights with Bernard Hopkins, didn't he, where he lost his way and was perhaps hypnotised slightly by Bernard Hopkins's, you know, brilliance and mischief and everything else. And we've seen it a lot where fighters don't really recover from that. But Pascal was showing signs that he could be a force. We've mentioned Lemieux and Murray for Golovkin. Obviously, the light heavyweight version of Golovkin is Sergei Kovalev. Pascal versus Kovalev, good fight?
I think it is a good fight. Like, obviously, we all want to see Kovalev Adonis Stevenson. I'm pretty sure the Kovalev can want that fight too. But in the meantime, whilst they're trying to flush Stevenson out, fighting Pascal is a great move. For a start, it sort of Stevenson's based in Canada as well. So it puts Kovalev on the map there. And Pascal was looking good. He looks like a decent opponent. He doesn't look like I doubt anyone's going to pick Pascal over Kovalev. But could be exciting, that fight. And it makes you think Pascal's fought everyone he can, really.
Yeah.
You know, the war with Frotch was a long time ago. But, you know, he's fought Hopkins, Butte,
Dawson.
All right.
Names just keep on rolling. Okay, so let's go to Bethnal Green. Let's go back in time. Bethnal Green, December 6th. John Denham was there at ringside for the latest Prize Fighter. Now, I used to really, really enjoy Prize Fighter. I'm not saying it was, you'd see, the greatest boxing from a purist standpoint ever, but I just used to quite like the format. A few tins of beer at home. And I'd quite like to watch it. I intended to watch this one. I haven't seen any of it. I've got to be honest. Haven't seen any of it. So for my benefit and for anybody's benefit that's listening that didn't see it, talk us through it as succinctly as you can.
It was good. Prize Fighter, I thought, was beginning to run its course. I wasn't going to this one. You know, obviously I'm a consummate professional, but I must admit I wasn't hugely looking forward to it. I've been out in Macau watching Manny Pacquiao, and it's like, oh, I got to go to East London, watch these guys in Prize Fighter. But you know, I swallowed my pride, went along, and it was actually really good. You know, from the first fight was a cracking three rounds between Craig White and Lee Martin. They absolutely went for it. And this installment of Prize Fighter was a good one. It was exciting. Everyone tore into each other and got stuck in. You were never bored. It's sort of what Prize Fighter was all about. I think we were at that heavyweight one early in the year that just sort of drained you of your will to live.
Yeah.
But this was different. You know, it was full of the action, thrills and spills that you want from Prize Fighter. I don't think there should be too many in a year. I think you only need probably a couple of the lighter weights with sort of hungry contenders who want to get somewhere with it. But this was all right.
Okay, what about where does previously prize fighter has led to bigger and better things? Gavin Rees reinvigorated his career when he won it.
Martin Murray sort
Martin
of made
Murray,
his name
exactly,
prize fighter.
Was one. He's a really good example. Audley
brought
Harrison.
Audley back. I was there for that night.
Audley Harrison's triumph really set him up for things that he otherwise would not have secured. But anyway, yeah, so Carroll, where can he go?
Well, it's interesting because he did only have a few fights before this. So, you know, hopefully it's given him a bit of a name. And he's the kind of, you know, if we start getting some more shows in Ireland, I could see him being in a few decent fights in Ireland, building a bit of a fan base.
Yeah.
But it is still, you know, I think even after Prize Fighter, he's only had six fights, so it's too early to say where he's going to go. Prize Fighter doesn't necessarily launch everyone. Larry Akindale was in a sort of similar situation, as in he'd only had a few fights and sort of made his name looking excellent in Prize Fighter, and we haven't seen much of Larry since, though. I think he's sort of working his
Patrick
way back
Mendy
up.
As well as one that springs to mind, didn't quite work out for him.
Yeah. But John O'Carroll certainly, you know, he looked good. I mean, he had a close one with Gary Buckland, their semi-final certainly could have gone either way. So Buckland's not out for the count.
Okay, right.
Martin Ward in his first...
Oh, go on, keep on talking, go on.
Martin Ward had a very close, controversial fight with Maxie Hughes. It was a draw.
Was that a justifiable draw, did you think?
Yeah, I thought the knockdowns the referee decided to give. One was a headbutt and the other, Martin's clearly slipped. If you discount those and don't award the knockdowns, I thought a draw was actually quite fair. And they're going to have it was a good fight, it was close. Ward's got plenty to improve on. Maxie Hughes can take a lot of confidence because he really gave a very talented boxer all he could handle. So the rematch, which will have to happen next year, will be interesting. So it was good, really, even though obviously no one leaves a draw very happy.
Okay, let's move on to the impending weekend. There's a big, big opportunity for Amir Khan against Devin Alexander. Amir Khan, he's probably with the only exception really of Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather, in terms of his following on social media and the interest that he gets, Amir Khan is the one of the leading boxers in the world, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I know from experience this week, the stuff when we put stuff on our website, which is filtered through Facebook, we get a lot of comments. Many of them are distasteful, they're insulting, but love him or hate him, Amir Khan gets attention.
Yeah, he does get a reaction out of people.
Why do you think there's so much dislike for Amir Khan?
I don't know. It's not really. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's merited. He's got tremendous skills, but he's also got, you know, he loves getting stuck in, which is what gets him in trouble. You know, maybe the fact that he's got the knockouts against him, that people see that as sort of a sign of weakness, and that's where they focus their criticism. You know, Vladimir Klitschko was heavily criticised for getting stopped a couple of times. Maybe it's this sort of, you know, he was very successful, very young, which in Britain, you know, maybe people resent a bit, you know, people getting success so soon. People like, you know, a story of lots of suffering and lots of hard work. I'm not saying he doesn't work hard, but you know, he hit the top very quickly. But then it was his skills that got him there. So I don't really know. He does, you know, he does say comments where if you were like his PR person, you think, oh, that's, you know, going to wind up people the wrong way. His confidence borders on arrogance sometimes, or certainly his confidence, which is justified, can certainly be perceived as arrogance. I don't think people are going to love the fact that he spent, what, 20 grand on a pair of shorts.
No, that really was a move that will not do him any favours, I don't think. But also, would we care so much if it was someone else?
Yeah, or was that if it was Floyd Mayweather, you'd expect it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Aren't they going to get ruined in the fight, though, or get sweat on them, possibly blood?
Well, they're going to charity, apparently. They're going to charity, these shorts. Well, they don't. Do you know what? I've seen these shorts. They don't. I wouldn't pay 20 grand for them. That's for damn sure.
Are they machine washable?
It's a good question.
Yeah, I mean,
I doubt it.
So what, you got to get? How do you get them cleaned afterwards?
I don't know. Dry clean, maybe?
Can you say, these are my 20 grand shorts? Do you have to insure them?
I would have thought so. I would have thought so.
I wouldn't have spent 20 grand on a pair of shorts.
Do you think it's
I've
the
got
fact...
like a sombrero, maybe.
Do you think it's the fact, because he's lost...
Possibly slippers.
Maybe slippers. But anyway, he's lost to Bridie Prescott in emphatic fashion. He's been knocked out by Danny Garcia. He lost controversially to Lamont Peterson, I felt.
Yeah. But then Lamont Peterson subsequently failed a drug test.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But he hasn't seemed that keen to go back and avenge those defeats, yet he still seems to be calling out Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. Is that perhaps why he's getting under people's skin?
Yeah, maybe. But then it's not like he's taking soft touches. Like, Collazo was a great win. And, you know, Alexander's a good fight as well. Like, you know, tricky guy. But yeah, so maybe maybe if he had avenged his defeats, people would warm to that more. Maybe he sort of... You know, he didn't hang around to fight at British level and fight for the British title. So maybe that didn't sort of endear him to his local fan base, or potential local fan base. He went over to the States pretty early in his career, whereas sort of like Ricky Hatton built up that massive fan base before he transferred to Las Vegas. So yeah, maybe people don't like that.
It's not a sentiment that I share, by the way. I mean, for the record, I've got great admiration for Amir Khan, particularly the way. I mean, I've got great admiration for any human being that really, you know, really strives to be the best that they can be. And I don't think the fact that Khan hasn't gone back and fought Prescott, or at this stage hasn't fought Garcia, isn't a reflection on his mindset in that he thinks that he won't be able to beat those guys. I just think that he wants to get to the top and be regarded as the best of his time, you know, as quickly as possible. And he's taking steps to do that. I mean, you mentioned Collazo. Devin Alexander is no gimme. And you certainly can make a case that if he gets past Alexander impressively, that Manny Pacquiao aside, in that welterweight division, he's the most appealing opponent for Floyd Mayweather.
Maybe. I mean, Bradley's a top level welterweight.
Yeah. But would you rather see Bradley Mayweather, or would you? Let's presume that Khan beats Alexander emphatically, impressively. There's no question marks. Let's say he does that. Would you then rather see Khan versus Mayweather, or Bradley versus Mayweather?
Yeah, I think Khan Mayweather would be, like, Khan would make it more exciting than Tim Bradley would. But every time you do worry about Khan, like, talking up Mayweather immediately before he fights, you know, he's fighting someone else. Because I seem to remember, ahead of Lamont Peterson,
yeah.
he was banging on, you know, beating the drum for the Mayweather fight, and he just seemed to have taken his eye off the ball, and he ended up, you know, fighting the fight Peterson wanted him to, you know, doing it quite well, to be fair, but he wasn't fighting his own fight. So you do worry about this, you know, spending too much time talking about Khan and spending too much time talking about Mayweather and Pacquiao is could be an ominous sign. And yeah, I'd quite like to see Khan Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah, that would be. And I do think that with it's very rare that he's in a dull fight.
Yeah,
it's very rare, very very rare indeed. And I'm trying to think of a dull fight that he's been in. That you,
Molina.
Yeah, that wasn't brilliant. That wasn't brilliant.
Zing.
But no, he seems to. I mean, it's kind of boxing all over, isn't it? I mean, a year or so ago, before he'd fought Collazo, people were saying, "Oh, he moved to Virgil Hunter too quickly. He dispensed with Freddie Roach." But he looked very, very disciplined, more so perhaps than ever against Collazo.
Yeah.
And at that point as well, there was high stakes for Khan to impress. So, you know, let's hope for his own sake that, you know, he has learnt those lessons and he will approach this Alexander fight with the attention that it deserves. Devin Alexander, for me, looked not shot against Sean Porter last December in Brooklyn, but he didn't look quite right there. Well, how much of a threat is Devin Alexander, do you think, to Amir Khan?
I think he is, but I could well be wrong. Like, I always, you know, on Devin Alexander's way up, he looked sensational, and then it's just sort of not quite clicked into place for him since his loss to Tim Bradley, really. I think he says he took Sean Porter lightly. He certainly showed he was tough against Porter. He took a lot of big punches. But I think on his day, if his mindset's right, Devin Alexander, you know, should be a real threat to Khan. I don't think it's going to be an easy fight. It might not be the greatest blend of styles for a fight, but I think he could definitely make, you know, he's got fast hands too. I think he can make it difficult for Khan. Has Khan ever looked great against the Southpaw? Yeah, against Collazo, he looked brilliant. So maybe it will be Khan's day.
I think it's not a straightforward fight for Khan, but I think he'll win this quite comfortably against Devin Alexander. I just do. On the undercard, interesting one: Keith Thurman, Leonard Bundu. Thurman, a lot of promise, good puncher, exciting, charismatic. Leonard Bundu, approaching 40 years older, he might actually be 40 now, kind of really done it the hard way. Is Bundu out of his depth? Could Thurman perhaps be overrated? Are we going to get some answers?
Yeah, on Saturday the weekend, I think it's a huge step up for Bundu. Thurman looks like he's got the power to get himself out of trouble. I think the other aspects of his boxing are a bit, you know, you think a wily campaigner like Bundu could give him some problems, but I'd see Thurman's power and Thurman being that level above would come through in the end.
Points?
I reckon Thurman might stop him.
Yeah.
He might need to.
Thurman's another guy that's kind of been mentioning Floyd Mayweather, not nearly as loudly as Amir Khan has, but Thurman Mayweather, that a potential fight for 2015? Would you like to see that one?
Yeah, I would. I think Thurman's a sort of, you know, he's a big puncher, he's a good character. I'd like to see him up there in the mix. So I think on Saturday Thurman's sort of auditioning for his shot at Mayweather as well.
Okay.
He wouldn't beat him though.
No, I'm kind of anti Thurman Mayweather. I'm kind of anti Mayweather against anyone where there's just so many of these guys now like Keith Thurman that Mayweather could kind of handpick. And I don't mean any disrespect to Keith Thurman, but I'd be intrigued by Amir Khan against Mayweather. I just think Khan's style could give Mayweather some problems, or certainly give him something to think about, something he hasn't seen before. I think he'd win every round against someone like Keith Thurman. Anyway, let's move on. There is another bill in Las Vegas. Daniel Herbert filed a really, really good read for the website on Timothy Bradley, in that, and the essence of it was, even though he's, and you kind of touched on it as well with what you said earlier about that Bradley would be an interesting choice for Mayweather, and I kind of just said no, more or less. But Bradley, you know, despite the fact that he's a day or so away from headlining a card in Las Vegas, he's also in danger of becoming boxing's most forgotten man, yeah, in a way. And that was what Daniel Herbert was kind of getting at with his blog. So Bradley against Diego Chavez in the Cosmopolitan, which I believe holds around 3,000 or 4,000, so it will be on a smaller scale than the...
Yeah, I think it's sort of 3,000 or...
Right.
Between 2,000 and 3,000. So much smaller scale than the MGM show.
Have you got much interest in this fight? We'll move on to Andy Lee, Matt Korobov, which I think we're both looking forward to. But let's talk about Bradley to start off with. Have you got interest in Bradley Chavez?
Yeah, I do actually. But then I quite like Tim Bradley. I think he's like, you know, someone who can outpoint and, you know, outbox Juan Manuel Marquez. You know, that's a serious fighter on your hands. The war he had with Provodnikov at the start of 2013, you know, shows he can really get stuck in as well. So I really like Tim Bradley. I'm not quite sure why he hasn't, you know, why he hasn't sort of become, why he isn't more popular. But he's not.
So I don't think he's unpopular, though, is he? I think he was hurt. I think he was hurt by the fact, or his popularity was probably hurt by the fact that he was given a gift decision in the first Manny Pacquiao fight.
Yeah.
That, in an odd sort of a way, didn't help him, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Even though he became the first man in many years to beat Manny Pacquiao, nobody really thought of him as the winner in that fight, and maybe one or two people, that seemed to hinder him. But he hasn't been without opportunity. He had that fight against Pacquiao. You mentioned the Marquez fight. He's since had the rematch with Pacquiao, which incidentally, I thought he fought an odd fight there. He really seemed to be there to prove a point. And I think his heart ruled his head a little bit there. He really wanted to kind of, it was clear that he thought he was going to knock Manny Pacquiao out. And as a result, he was widely outpointed.
Yeah.
So he's certainly one of the best welterweights in the world. Yeah. You can still make a case that he's one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world. But the money-making stakes is a long, long way down there, isn't he, in terms of his marketability?
Yeah, as in he's done well to have those big fights, but in those big fights, he was, you know, the crowd was on Marquez's side, the crowd was on Pacquiao's side. He's not sort of well-supported in that sense. So I think he's got to sort of, well, yeah, try, you know, have fights like this, get in some wars, get people talking about him again. You know, Chavez is, you know, he's strong, he's heavy-handed, he's a rough customer, judging
from. It's a bit like the Provodnikov matchup, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, to box smart, he'll just, you know, if he boxes intelligently and just boxes, then he'll probably outpoint him easily. Maybe it won't have too many people talking about him after the weekend. But if he does get stuck in and have a war, then that could certainly boost him in the marketability state. Is marketability a word?
Yeah.
All right.
If he was to, I mean, what kind of opponents could be next for Tim Bradley? This is where I struggle. Okay, yeah, he goes in and has another Ruslan Provodnikov type epic struggle, yet comes out victorious, boosts his credibility, and yeah, then doors kind of open that we didn't even know were there. But if Bradley goes in and does what he does best, boxes to a plan, wins comfortably on points, where on earth can he go from there? Because that's kind of the fight that I suspect is going to transpire. So where could Tim Bradley go from there? It's a struggle for him, isn't it? Yeah. Which is not his fault, but it's kind of the way boxing is in a way.
Yeah, but there are a lot of good people around the weight.
Go on then, give me a fight. Give me who Bradley would get if he beat Chavez.
Well, I was about to say Danny Garcia moving up, but I don't think that fight would happen if Garcia is managed by Al Heyman, who doesn't seem to work with top-ranked fighters. Who else is around? You know, we could let Chris Algieri back out the cage.
It's not massive, though, is it? Bradley Algieri, no thanks.
Bradley Keith Thurman.
That's all right.
Yeah, all right, well, let's do that then.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Andy Lee, Matt Korobov. Really, really, really intriguing WBO, vacant WBO middleweight title fight. Poised, isn't it? Poised. Yeah. Andy Lee, 2 years. Now with Adam Booth, following the passing of Emmanuel Stewart. And Andy Lee looks... Perhaps he's going to fulfil his potential. Well, Matt Korobov, very, very impressive amateur who hasn't come anywhere near close to duplicating that kind of form as a professional.
Yeah, he's made very slowly. Sort of, he hasn't excited fans, has he, on his way up?
Korobov is the favourite. Why? Is it just because of that promise, do you think?
I think
because
so.
Because Lee has been in with better fighters at a professional level.
Yeah, presumably it's because of his technical competence, and I suppose people he's done everything that he's needed to do so far, and maybe people are expecting him to do the same. Now he is stepping up a level to fight for this world title, because like you say, Lee, he's fought world level, got a hell of a punch on him. So he could be dangerous. He has had Andy Lee's had a hard career himself as well.
He has, yeah. He's been in some wars that shouldn't have been wars.
Yeah.
I remember Andy Lee is another one of those for me when I remember, I think it might have been Carl Daniels, who was on the decline, former titleist, who he knocked out with such kind of effort. It was effortless the way he did it. And at that point, I thought he was going to go all the way. Emmanuel Stewart was also kind of heavily touting him. I think Andy Lee was about 10-0. Kelly Pavlik at that point was the world middleweight champion, and Emmanuel Stewart was saying, I'd put Andy Lee in with Kelly Pavlik now. And Andy Lee really did look like he was going to go all the way. Then he lost to Brian Vera, exposed to an extent against Brian Vera after he looked like he was going to get Vera out of there early. Really, really good fight. And he hasn't quite put it all together again. There's been flashes of it. His last fight, again, is another example of why he's such an exciting fighter against John Jackson. Really, really under the cosh, and then he uncorked one of the best punches I've ever seen to knock Jackson out with one shot. Adam Booth this week has said that, yeah, it was a wonderful shot, but he was not impressed with the way that Andy Lee was performing. Prior to that, he was making mistakes, but Adam Booth's words were, I'm not hoping that Andy Lee wins, I'm expecting him to win. But why will Andy Lee all of a sudden now not make those mistakes against Matt Korobov?
You know, it depends if, you know, can Korobov sort of apply the same amount of pressure that, what's Korobov going to be like? Is it going to be an awkward clash between two southpaws? You know, is Korobov going to want to just fight at his own pace and at his own rhythm like he has been doing? In that case, you know, if Lee doesn't get sort of sucked into that, you know, and uses his experience at world level, because he was doing pretty well against Chavez Jr., wasn't he, before the sort of the size?
Yeah, he was doing well.
So I think I can see why Korobov's the favourite, but I wouldn't pick a winner with any confidence.
Okay. I think I'm more intrigued actually now, as time passes, I'm more intrigued to see this fight than I am Khan Alexander on paper is perhaps the pick of the weekend action, but for me this Andy Lee Matt Karabov fight is it's hard, and fights tend to be exciting when you can't pick a winner.
Yeah, no, I'm more sort of intrigued by this fight, really interested in it, but I'm not sure, you know, and it is for a proper world title, but I'm not sure if it's going to kick off the way a fight with Amir Khan might.
I think the thing is, and Andy Lee, in a similar way to Amir Khan, Andy Lee, many times when he's won, he's looked unsteady doing so. That's the one thing that's stopping me really from wholeheartedly picking Andy Lee to win this fight, because I think he's got a lot of attributes that could really give Karabov a lot of problems. But I've seen him in 10 rounders against far inferior opponents where he starts off really well, and by the end of it, he's just struggling. He's being knocked all over the ring. That Brian Vera fight, the Chavez capitulation, it's all... The evidence for me is leaning me towards Karabov, but love to see Andy Lee do it. One of the nicest guys in boxing. But, yeah, no, interesting.
Do you think Peter Quillin vacated the title to avoid Karabov?
I don't know. I don't know. It was a curious decision from Peter Quillin, particularly as we've heard absolutely nothing from him since.
Yeah.
We were told that decision was because there were massive opportunities awaiting him. He was going to target the huge names in middleweight division. There's been no sign of him. Had he said, okay, I'm moving up to super middleweight, you'd understand it. But, and also, there was the huge purse on offer.
Yeah, or maybe it was a case of...
I think he was probably advised by his promoter.
Maybe Al Heyman didn't want to work with that promoter, new promoter.
Jose Benavidez, talking about can't miss prospects, Jose Benavidez gets to step up Mauricio Herrera.
That's a cracking fight on paper, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Because, you know, it's... You know, like you say, it's a proper...
You sounded really excited then.
Yeah, was it?
Almost drunk.
Almost drunk. very drunk. No. What was I talking about? That's because I just don't know what's going to happen. I suppose if Benavidez wins, then he is living up to that potential. That, you know, a few years ago, he was a very hot prospect.
Yeah.
But, you know, Herrera gave Danny Garcia all he could handle. This is a crossroads fight, but an interesting one. I don't know who's going to win.
Neither do I. You would think it would be Benavidez, but gone off the boil a bit of late. Right, anything else that we should be talking about, John? Because we've been going for nearly three quarters of an hour now.
Naz in the Hall of Fame.
Now,
Frotch, what's going to happen?
Frotch, yeah, we've got an exclusive interview with Frotch in this week's Boxing News. Also got Matthew Macklin in there discussing his future, but we will now talk about Nassim Hamed. I actually was lucky enough to be on the voting panel for this year's Hall of Fame, and I actually voted for Nassim Hamed. Hamed was one of the guys that I voted for.
So you made this happen, Matt.
I was one of many people that made this happen. I just think for what he achieved in the boxing ring during that time, I think from about 1995-96 all the way to the turn of the century, he was by far and away the most exciting featherweight for a period of time, probably 3 or 4 years. You could without question say he was the best featherweight in the world. And people always say, well, yeah, he lost to Marco Antonio Barrera. He wasn't the only one, and it's not as if he didn't fight anybody prior to that. The likes of Tom Johnson, Wilfredo Vasquez, Vianney Bungu, Manuel Medina, Paul Ingle, all titleists. Naz got the better of all of them. Never a great fan of his out of the ring persona. I found it arrogance is something in people which I absolutely despise.
He wasn't a role model, really.
No, but you say that. You say he wasn't a role model. I think he probably was while he was fighting. I think many people looked up to Naz. They enjoyed that flip over the ring. They enjoyed the cockiness. And he came along, and as Dominic Ingall says in this week's guest column, he came along at a time when Britain was a great place to be. You know, you had
the Spice Girls,
exactly, Tony Oasis, Blair. Tony Blair.
Doesn't sound that amazing.
No, it was. I mean, that was when I was at my peak in those days. I remember 1996. I had an Oasis floppy haircut. Or a Blur floppy haircut. It's a bit more Damon Albarn than Liam Gallagher.
I see what's
to be honest.
Going on here, man.
And going and just feeling on top of the world.
where did it all go wrong?
I don't know. It started to go wrong in about 1997 when I started to go bald. but that was a time, and Prince Nassim was very, very much a part of that. Euro 96. Who can forget that Paul Gascoigne goal?
Well,
that was something, wasn't it?
What a time to be young.
I remember being in the local boozer watching England annihilate the Netherlands 4-1, Sheringham and Alan Shearer. And that was one of the greatest nights of my life.
Friends was on TV.
Yeah, Friends was on TV for the first time. There were episodes we'd never seen before. But now... As Mickey Van says in his column this week, which you can read online, because of what Nassim did after he retired, he should not be in the Hall of Fame. We won't dwell on it too much, but he went to prison. And as a result of that, as kind of almost what you say, he's not a good role model. Therefore, he should not be in the Hall of Fame. Is that a fair argument, do you think?
Well, you know, yes. Well, yes and no. As in, a boxer doesn't have to be a role model. And if he's being judged solely on his boxing, or you know, any athlete doesn't have to be a role model if he's being judged solely on his boxing, and the sort of excitement, entertainment he brought to the sport as well, that would qualify him through the Hall of Fame. I suppose people are uneasier. They want us, if someone's committed a crime, they want them to have been, you know, at least, you know, they want them to have atoned for it or done their time. And so then if you feel that Naz has, which, you know, I don't really, which I suppose I do, then I don't really have a problem with being in the Hall of Fame, and maybe it's overdue. But I suppose I'm sure you could come up with examples of what someone's done in their life outside of boxing or outside of their sport would disqualify them from being sort of honoured by the sport. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it should be held against him if people feel like he's sort of done his time and atoned for his crime.
Yeah, I think that the Boxing Hall of Fame is not full of angels by any means. The other guys to join him were, or will be, I should say, Riddick Bowe, former world heavyweight champion. I understand that. I didn't vote for Riddick Bowe. I just felt the highlight of his career was that fantastic win, or really the fantastic trilogy with Evander Holyfield, but he shone brightly, but not for long enough, really. And the one that really did confuse me, though, was Ray Mancini, who, crowd pleaser, but I'm still a bit puzzled as to what he did to merit a spot in the Hall of Fame. But Nassim Hamed, no argument with it whatsoever. He could have done himself more favours. I'll go along with that. He seemed to get kind of caught up in his own importance. He was caught up in his own talent. By the time he was world champion, he felt that he'd already done it all. He didn't. His training went off the boil. You know, I remember spending time up in the Ingles last year or the year before to do quite a lengthy feature with those guys, and that's what they said. He went from being the first person to turn up at the gym in the morning, and then when he was at the height of his fame, he would be knocking on the door at 11 o'clock at night saying, come on then, I've got time for an hour's training now, come on, let's go and have a... You know, it wasn't important. He felt he was too good to train, or to train to the levels that he had. He didn't feel he could get any better. He didn't want to learn any new techniques. And I think if you watch his career, it kind of comes across in that. But his brilliance, his natural brilliance, allowed him to be the best featherweight in the world for 3 or 4 years, if not more, really, if not more. I just think the run from 1995 to 2001 was an incredible ride, and one we haven't seen before or since in British boxing. But I do completely take on board the people that say after the Barrera fight, he should have knuckled down and really shown what he was made of. And if he'd have done that, he'd have been in the Hall of Fame years ago.
Yeah, I suppose the case against him is that, you know, he achieved a lot, but didn't achieve what people expected of him, given his brilliant attention, brilliant potential.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, anything else, John, before we go? Now, closing in on the 51-minute mark, we've been talking.
We've been rattling on
stuff. I'm a bit concerned about my excitement over 1996.
I want to go back to that. I want to find out more about young Matt Christie.
No, we'll leave that. We'll leave that for now. Okay, what are we working on at the moment, John? We're putting together the
Christmas double issue.
Yeah.
Lots of good stuff in that.
Yeah, there is. There is. Anything in particular?
That I'm working on.
No, anything that you've read so far that's going to go in next week's issue that you.
We've got a feature on Oscar De La Hoya. That's a good read. An article about Edwin Valero that's very interesting. You know, he's very much a sort of, well, how do you just sort of describe someone who was a murderer, a fighter, an exciting fighter when he was in the ring? It's sort of, you don't admire him, but you're fascinated by someone like that. And Kieran Mulvaney's written, you know, an excellent piece about that sort of, you know, that phenomenon that was Edwin Valero. I need to write a piece about Vasyl Lomachenko, which I will do.
Is that for the double issue?
That is.
Okay.
How do you feel about that, Matt?
I'm looking forward to it. And just in case this is your last podcast of the year, because I suspect there will only be one other after this one before Christmas. What has been your, because you undoubtedly, out the Boxing News staffers, have been the most travelled of all of us.
Well, and around the UK.
Yeah, but you've, previously you were banging on about seeing Manny Pacquiao. That was quite a long way away in terms of distance. So what has been your highlight?
I've been lucky enough to be a ringside and get some really good fights. But yeah, being Macau was brilliant. You know, getting to spend a couple of afternoons just watching Pacquiao train. He looked really focused, really motivated. That was sort of unique. But yeah, so it's been a good year. But the whole Pacquiao show with his crazy, with his ludicrous entourage of 300 people that he brought with him, one of whom tried to throw me out of the Pacquiao training session, another of whom discreetly attempted to borrow my press pass. But I kind of needed it, so. So yeah, it was good.
Okay, brilliant. Cheers, I really appreciate your time, John.
What's been your highlight of the year, Mef?
My highlight of the year was probably that man Manny Pacquiao, I would say, against Timothy Bradley in April. And
the Mayweather show must have thrown up some interesting moments.
The Mayweather show was good. I enjoyed the Mayweather show, the Marcus Maidana rematch, but I think really there was a sense before the Manny Pacquiao fight in April, and it may have been a sense that I'd kind of manufactured myself, but that we were about to witness the fall of Manny Pacquiao. And, you know, as he made his way to the ring, I was kind of consumed by this wow, we're about to witness
the end
of an era. And it was, you know, that atmosphere, that taut atmosphere kind of stuck around for the entirety of the fight, really, or until about the 10th or 11th round, because it was a good fight. I enjoyed the fight.
It was a proper high level fight, wasn't it?
Yeah, so that was probably my highlight.
Pacquiao brought himself back off that win, really.
Well, exactly, and I think that I think no one can deny that Pacquiao is the wrong side of his peak, but he's not that far away from it, and he's still, for me, one of the best fighters, probably number two pound for pound, probably after Floyd Mayweather. But
he's number three.
You can't have Andre Ward anymore, can we?
Too inactive, yo.
He needs to get active. Who would be number three?
Bradley. Rigondo, or as they say in America, Rigondo.
I don't know.
Not up for that. Kovalev.
Golovkin.
But who's he actually beating?
Cotto.
Who's he actually beating? Okay.
Okay, right, let's go. No, this is getting silly now. All right, so we will, or two of the team will be back next week, probably for an end of the year spectacular. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Apologies if it all got a little bit weird and drawn out. And we will be back next week. Thanks a lot.